From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Europe, Russia, and the rest of the world have now had some time to react to last week's NATO summit in Prague, where the alliance welcomed seven new members: Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia were invited to join the alliance in 2 years. Martin Walker is chief international correspondent for UPI. He's been tracking reactions to the Bush appearance at the summit, and he joins us now with a report. Martin, after long last, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be back on the air with you, Brooke.
So what do you think? Bush won what he wanted at NATO, right?
Well, certainly that's what the conservative European newspapers are saying. The Times of Britain and the Telegraph of Britain were both talking about Bush's diplomatic triumph. Simia of Slovakia wrote an editorial in which they said that we find that once again, when the United States takes a firm position and sets a firm lead, the rest of the allies will follow along. And although the liberal European newspapers seem to agree that this was a diplomatic success for President Bush, many of them said a success but. For example, The Guardian of Britain said in an editorial, by enlisting in the Pentagon's Foreign Legion, European NATO allies will now march to Washington's latest political tune. By imposing streamlined U.S. command, there'll be no repeat of the Kosovo war by committee. By defining required capability and burden sharing, Europe will both pay more and increasingly be locked into acquiring U.S.-made material and weapon systems. By co-opting NATO coalitions of the willing, accusations of American imperialism will in theory be harder to sustain. But a green light in Prague is going to be seen as a political endorsement of President Bush's aggressive global security strategy.
Martin, I'm curious, how does this view of NATO as an American proxy differ from how NATO's been viewed in the past? Is this more of the same, or is there some advance here that I'm not picking up?
Well, I think the advance is one that was spelt out by the Daily Telegraph in London, which said that this is a clear attempt by Washington to trump Europe's effort to create its own European Union force of 60,000 men. What we're seeing here is a clear American lesson. Either the Europeans remedy their operational deficiencies, or the alliance will become irrelevant because, quite simply, the Americans no longer really need the Europeans.
And if the Europeans feel that way, I would imagine that the Russians would feel much the worse, since NATO has now expanded to the very edges of the former Soviet Union.
Again, it depends on your political point of view. Writing in Moskovsky Komsomolets, Melo Sturua, whom many of us remember as a very loyal communist commentator back in the old days, is now saying that Russia has no choice but to become an ally of this American-led world.
Moskovsky Komsomolets has been traditionally a liberal paper, so that can't be a unanimous verdict in Russia.
It absolutely isn't. And in fact, there are some very, very hostile statements. For example, one that was printed in Spain's El País came from the chief of staff of the Russian Armed Forces, General Yuri Baluyevsky, who said that, I quote, "In my view, NATO is now so big it's become impossible to govern. Expansion will only make this worse. The measures NATO is supposed to be taking to combat international terrorism simply do not respond to the real threat."
Let's turn now to the Arab press. They've had some time now to react to what seems to have been an American media blitz, the war for hearts and minds that we've talked about. It doesn't seem to be going very well.
No, in fact, this $15 million that the State Department's new, as it were, propaganda office, being run by Undersecretary of State Charlotte Beers, to produce advertisements in the press and TV clips, video clips of happy American Muslims, is getting a pretty much thumbs down throughout the Islamic world. Morocco's Demain magazine says the U.S. government wasted $15 million to publish the joy of American Muslims who live in the USA to better the image of America in the Islamic world. The money has all been wasted. But if the Americans want us to love them, they need to start being fair in the Middle East and impose some legitimacy on their Israeli ally. All Arabs know the military hardware used against the Palestinians is made and paid for by the United States. Al Hayat, which is a London-based paper and one of the outstanding Arab newspapers, says, I quote, "The US media campaign to improve its image so far has been a complete failure because it depends upon political propaganda, which is connected in the minds of the people as a means to protect lies and to twist the facts. The Americans, who do have arguments to make, have done themselves no favours with this particular campaign." In Tunisia's Le Quotidien, which is normally a very pro-Western paper, says of the campaign, "This is so funny. The Americans seem to think that they can polish their image with just a tiny little cloth, and that's all that's needed. In fact, if the Americans want to improve their image, they really should work at giving the United Nations its role as a guarantor of international law. They should stop using as an alibi the struggle against terrorism in order to interfere in other countries' sovereignty."
Well, once again, Martin, a thorough and fascinating job. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Martin Walker is chief correspondent for UPI.
Last week, amid protests by northern Nigerian Muslims about the Miss World pageant being staged in Lagos, a young journalist named Isioma Daniel remarked in an article that the Prophet Muhammad might have taken a fetching Miss World contestant for a wife. The sentiment enraged fundamentalists in the town of Kaduna, where subsequent rioting claimed more than 200 lives and sent both the pageant and the journalist scurrying out of the country. Ms. Daniel fled to the United States after a religious death sentence was issued on her own life. On Wednesday, the decree was declared null and void by Nigeria's central government, but not by the provincial officials who pronounced it, and tensions remain high. Joining me now is Nigeria expert Graham Furness, Dean of the Faculty of Languages and Culture at the University of London. Professor Furness, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
It has been an extraordinary week in Nigeria. Let's begin with some context. What is the state of Christian-Muslim tension in Nigeria in general, and how is it affecting the nation's politics?
It remains one of the main cleavages, fault lines, if you like, in terms of the politics of domestic life in Nigeria. Christian against Muslim is one of the most distinctive categorizations that people use when they're channeling all sorts of forms of economic and political competition.
The observation by Ms. Daniel was that Muhammad might have chosen one of these Miss World contestants as his wife. This set off the rioting. It was regarded as a slur against Muhammad. Was that a reckless piece of journalism by Nigerian standards? Was it surprising to you that this precipitated such violence?
I think you must understand what the Miss World contest represents for a northern Muslim. For them, what has seemed, in a sense, to perhaps to you or me, a harmless, flippant remark, is essentially bringing into connection with the Prophet Muhammad something which is essentially both a distasteful and an inappropriate and an immoral series of events and activities.
So it wasn't just a flippant remark. It was the suggestion that Muhammad might have been attracted by all of the worldliness and lasciviousness that Islam strictly forbids.
I think that's a very useful summary.
If Ms. Daniels was incautious, do you believe that there is a corresponding level of caution that characterizes Nigerian journalism that may keep journalists from being able to adequately, under normal circumstances, do their jobs fully? Do they pull their punches?
I wouldn't say they pull their punches. Nigerian journalists are a pugnacious bunch. They're a very brave and a very well-informed bunch. They investigate, they write on all the issues that concern ordinary Nigerians, corruption, misuse of government funds, the lack of the basic facilities, clean water, water supplies, electricity, jobs, drugs in the clinics. All of this is being discussed in Nigeria, and there are very brave journalists. But they would not gratuitously look to insult a religious community. It would be both uncalled for and would cause possible terrible reactions, because everybody understands the difficulties of holding Nigeria together, and the fact that it has stayed together for all these years is a remarkable tribute, really, to Nigerians' political skills. But it remains very tense, and make no mistake, Nigeria is flammable.
I'm just curious, now that these events have played out to a shocked world, are the echoes of shock embarrassing Nigeria, or what reaction are they having?
I think there is a sense of embarrassment. The Nigerian government was very keen to try and reconstruct a public profile for Nigeria, which has had a very bad press for some time. There's a sense, I think, that for ordinary Nigerians, all of this was unnecessary. The real problems facing Nigeria are to do with schooling, housing, water, jobs. These are the things they want the world to concentrate upon. Things are slowly improving. But the prospect that the further dislocation caused by this on top of the difficult economic circumstances that people are living in creates a real sense of despair for many ordinary Nigerians, I think.
Let me ask you one last question. If you're a journalist in Nigeria and you write critically about the government or about corruption, you can wind up in jail. If you write about the Miss World pageant, you can wind up under a death sentence amid rioting and death. Can you be a journalist in the year 2002 in Nigeria and really expect to be able to do your job?
Well, it's a good question. What I would say to you is that there are a lot of very brave journalists doing a damn good job in Nigeria. And yes, they do tread a dangerous and a fine line sometimes, but they are working in a free society in the sense that they do not live with the threat of military government locking them up any minute. There are strong elements of civil society. But yes, it is a dangerous profession. It's not an easy profession by any means.
All right. Graham Furness, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Graham Furness is a professor of African language and literature at the University of London.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We're devoting the rest of the show to reflections on sex and the media. And we thought France was a reasonable place to begin. France, at least by reputation, would seem to be the epitome of sexual freedom. But for the last 6 months, right-wing legislators have been campaigning to eliminate erotic movies from French television. Most of the controversy has been framed in terms of free speech versus family values. But as journalist Frank Browning reports, the new French porn wars touch much deeper fissures in French politics.
Starts with P, rhymes with T, and it stands for trouble. Pornographie télévisée. Like this softcore film, broadcast one recent Sunday at midnight, built around three female sorcerers out to get a hapless stud photographer. Lots of breasts, buns, and nipples, but no penetrating images. There are these days about 100 pornographic films a month on French television. Everything from whip-cracking sirens to kittenish coquettes to buff boys on the beach. Something for everyone. Or so it was until a campaign was launched to purge pornography from television. At the center of it all is Dominique Baudis, president of the Superior Council on Audiovisuals, or CSA, more or less the French version of the FCC. Baudis took office after the rightist victory last spring and quickly appointed the commission to study the effects of TV violence and pornography on the young.
It's impossible to accept that young children of 10 years old or 11 years old looking pictures very violent or pornographic picture, you know, is bad for the little child.
Simon Neri is a mother of two who's lived in Paris for 15 years. She says she doesn't want her children watching violent and degrading television shows, but she's very skeptical about attempts to ban programs.
I don't think that by simply saying, let's just repress everything that has to do with sex or so-called violence, especially without defining it, in the public media, is going to solve the problem. It's just going to make kids much more curious.
Her 13-year-old son, Nico, shrugs his shoulders.
I think it's basically stupid. Also, kids bring, like, magazines, like porn magazines, to school. And even, like, sometimes they sell them.
Most kids will be able to figure out the new access codes to cable shows, Nico believes. And anyway, if you're clever, you can still find most anything on the Internet. To illustrate, he took his mom and me upstairs to the bedroom to show us a game he had downloaded.
In this game, you're basically some mafia guy, and you have to kill people and that kind of stuff. So, now you have to find a prostitute. Okay, here's one. Okay. So now that you took the prostitute in your car, you have to go to, like, kind of like a secret area where there aren't a lot of people going by. See, you don't really see anything, but what the noise is saying and like is that they're basically having sex in the car.
So far, the proposed regulation of sexual images and pornography has not touched the Internet. But a number of bills are still circulating through Parliament, and there has been talk of policing the web. Like Nico, many critics have pointed out that kids are perhaps more likely to scour the net than search out late-night cable TV for porn. Not all these initiatives have come from conservatives, explains Davina Frau Meggs, a sociologist who served on the commission examining violence and pornography.
The left is coming at pornography and at the crack up on pornography because of the women at issue and the issue of identity politics, how to preserve the rights of women and their own dignity, etc. The right is coming at it from a point of view of morals and politics of morality, which is to say how to preserve family, matrimony, moral order, and how to keep the hierarchy of youth and adults in place.
And TV is not their only interest. Many of those who want to get rid of blue movies are also after France's oldest and completely legal profession, prostitution. The Minister of Interior has even proposed prosecuting prostitutes who solicit their customers publicly, in effect forcing them off the streets where they earn their living. In response, an Organization of Paris prostitutes has staged street demonstrations and recently threatened to start naming the politicians on their client lists. There's no direct link between the anti-porn campaign on TV and the crackdown against prostitutes that's taking place in several cities, says Davina Frau Meggs. One is about the effect of media, the other about the morality of certain work. Yet the timing of these campaigns, she believes, does have a common source, and that is the threat posed by the far-right politician Jean-Marie Le Pen, who, on an anti-immigrant law and order campaign, came in second in this year's presidential elections. To fend off the far right, she believes, the government proffered its own list of enemies to moral order.
Like young people, like prostitutes, like beggars, etc. It's not really the people who are causing the major trouble in France, but they're the ones who are perceived as creating a civil disorder. And I think that's why at the moment they're the major target.
And that perception, she says, came to a large degree from television reporting during this year's election campaigns.
It was argued that the elections went in such a swing towards the right because of the overemphasis on delinquency and youth abuse, etc. And it's true that for the major media channels, the reporting on youth violence increased by 50% to 60%.
Purse snatching and petty robbery among the young has increased in France in recent years, but only slightly, and violent crime among the young has held steady. As Frau Meggs sees it, France is coming more and more to resemble the United States in the way that the media both exploit sensationalist sex and violence and then generate public fear by over-reporting the actual level of violence. Just how far any of these sex, media, and behavior laws will go is hard to say. France is famous for passing laws to regulate almost everything, and the police and bureaucracy are equally famous for the tradition of fermer les yeux, or closing their eyes to laws that seem to them to be a waste of time. At the moment, not many people expect the street women to become Mormons, nor Emmanuel and the sexy sorcerers to turn into Snow White. For On the Media, I'm Frank Browning.
When we consider sex in the media, we should keep in mind that whenever there is a breakthrough in communications technology, pornography seems to play a pivotal role. There are many implications here for the broader issues of morality, sexuality, and censorship, but to our future letter writers, we say in advance, we won't be addressing them right now. Instead, we offer a brief history of pornography as an engine of technological progress.
This month, humanity crossed a communications Rubicon. Scientists at the MIT Touch Lab in Boston sent a physical sensation across the ocean to another scientist in London who was wearing a glove attached to a computer. It was brief, a flickering in the fingertip, but it was real. When we called the scientists, they bristled at the very idea that their achievement could have a sexual application. But history suggests that communications technology and pornography are as closely linked as a hand in a glove. Erotic engravings were traded throughout the ancient world, but it wasn't much of a business. Being that the business of pornography is business, it had to wait for the printing press.
After Gutenberg, in the 1500s, you actually have the first known writer making his living by writing pornography, though you might call it erotica then because it was still fairly expensive, a gentleman by the name of Pietro Aretino.
Jonathan Coopersmith, who teaches at Texas A&M, conducted exhaustive research into the matter for his paper called Pornography, Technology, and Progress. After movable type, he says the next great leap came centuries later with the development of photography. Now you didn't even have to know how to read.
An example, 1874, the London police raid a pornographer and they seize 130,248 obscene photographs.
Yowza. Now,
that's a huge amount of paper that's being consumed. In that sense, pornography is helping the distribution, helping the economic viability of photography.
And 20 years later, the pictures began to move. Imagine the viabilities.
In 1894, you have the first public movie. 1896, 2 years later, you have the first pornographic film. And ever since then, you've had more pornographic films produced than non-pornographic films.
In 1977, the very first pre-recorded videotape to go on sale was pornographic. It took another year for a non-porn tape to hit the market. And how about those clumsy camcorders, those expensive, unreliable early VCRs? Who bought those? Do-it-yourselfers, says Coopersmith, which explains why even the earliest models had a low light adjuster.
If you think about it, there are very few children's birthday parties which are really done with very low levels of light.
There are a couple of theories for why Sony Betamax, the superior video technology, lost the battle against the VHS format developed by JVC. For one thing, Sony was slow to license its technology, but perhaps just as important, pornographers preferred the cheaper, more convenient VHS format, which drove the market for tapes and players.
A lot of new technology goes through what's been referred to as the porn phase because it's kind of a proving ground for technology.
Brian Michaels is currently marketing a handy new service called Pocket Joy, which we'll get to in a moment.
You don't have to get big sponsorships to sponsor your new technology in order to keep your business afloat while you kind of prove it out. Instead, you put adult content on it. People pay a premium for that adult content, and that's enough to sustain your business while you build a better business case for other types of content.
There's certain experiences you can have in the world commercially that are free.
Author Douglas Rushkoff writes on culture and the Internet.
You know, you can get free saltines. You can get a free sample of laundry detergent. You know, you can get a free, maybe a picture of a woman's breast. But when push comes to shove, when you're going to want to see real sex or get liquor or have a vice experience, you end up having to pay.
For a long time, sex was the only commodity that sold on the Internet. And while other services continue to crash and burn, pornography profitably smolders on. Ask former stripper, now internet mogul, Danny Ash. When she got sick of the road, she took to the net. She had great pictures to sell, and other models joined her. Now she's a multimillionaire. She remembers when streaming video was new and bulky, and porn sites developed their own technology.
The adult entertainment industry was the first to use streaming JPEG push video, which was video that worked in web, in the browser, and didn't require a plugin. I think as an industry, we tend to jump in a little bit faster and tweak the technology and try to get it work faster.
And in any case, says Brian Michaels of Pocket Joy, which I said we'll get to in a minute, consumers of porn tend to be more patient than the average Joe.
I would say that a user would spend about 30 seconds trying to figure out how to view a clip from a baseball game, whereas they may spend 2 or 3 minutes trying to figure out how to view a video clip of an erotic situation. And then they're going to go and tell all of their friends how they did it.
I asked Danny Ash what she saw as the next frontier in high-tech porn.
There's a lot of talk about third-generation wireless stuff.
Cell phones.
Yes, about broadband cell phones, because you'll have all of that privacy and access that the Internet afforded you, but now you'll have mobility. So you don't have to sit in front of your desktop to watch the material. You can take it anywhere you'd like to be, anywhere that's more comfortable for you.
PocketJoy.com is a wireless internet webpage delivering full-color erotic images and jokes to the internet-capable mobile phone.
I told you we'd get to it. Brian Michaels says the service is up now, and when the technology to deliver moving pictures arrives, PocketJoy will be the first to use it.
Sure, we're talking about 1-minute dirty movies, 30-second dirty movies, 5-minute dirty movies, things of all types.
Pictures on film, on the net, on the phone, where does that leave radio on the technological frontier? Satellite radio is offering all sorts of new formats to specially equipped cars. Like basic cable, you have to pay a fee. But now, XM Satellite Radio is testing the waters with Playboy Radio for an additional cost of $2.99 a month. It will be the first premium service ever offered on satellite radio.
Did you get laid last night?
Nope.
Liar.
I did not.
She's such a
liar.
Here's one rule of thumb. Don't ever lie to our listeners.
Steve Gavanis is Executive Vice President for Programming for XM Satellite Radio.
It went on officially on September 3rd of this year, and we have very strong demand for it. There's a lot of people who spend a lot of time in their vehicles, a lot of time alone in their vehicles. There's a large male contingent, a lot of truck drivers among our early adopters. So when you kind of roll it all up, this does seem to be a natural starting place.
Basically, a very simple combination of two attractive young women sitting around talking dirty.
Well, I think that's a pretty good way to summarize.
If porn were a person with such a record of fueling technological progress, he would merit an award from, at the very least, the Chamber of Commerce. Because as far as driving the modern economy is concerned, porn is better than sex. Douglas Rushkoff.
This is an interesting one. Cowboys in the 1800s in America would pay more for a picture of a naked woman than they would to have sex with a prostitute. If a cowboy would pay more for a picture of a girl than for sex with the girl, then the picture of the girl has something that real sex doesn't. Repeatability, it has safety, it can't laugh at you. It can't tease you.
Technology has always isolated us, says Rushkoff. That's why we crave better and better technology, to occupy those lonely hours with flights into the unknown.
I would argue that what really drives technology and interactive technology is not the recreation of experiences that we can have in real life, but the invention of experiences that we can't have in real life. And that's when you see the real leaps forward.
Inevitably, then, the fingertip touch the scientists experienced this month will blossom into a full-blown bodysuit. In fact, there are companies working on that right now. That will be the moment when communications technology fulfills its ultimate potential to connect us entirely, antiseptically, and without fear of judgment or rejection with the person we most desire.
So that's where we're going. Now look back at where we've been. Half a century back to the Kinsey Report. The first part, issued in 1948, dealt with sexuality in the human male. The second, in 1953, with the human female. The two studies resounded like a thunderclap across America, bringing sex education programs like these in its wake.
I think he's somehow gotten the idea that he's weak. He's been awfully worried lately, so my husband says, about his own, sex activity.
By which I suppose you mean either his dreams and emissions at night or his urge to stimulate himself?
It's both, I guess. He seems to feel he's getting out of control or something.
It was 1953 when the 27-year-old Hugh Marston Hefner produced the first issue of Playboy at his kitchen table. He even drew the cartoons himself. There was no cover date because he didn't know if there would be a second issue. No one had ever dared to challenge the anti-obscenity laws of the U.S. Post Office to distribute nude pictures through the mail as a commercial venture. But Hefner succeeded. That first issue sold 50,000 copies, not least because it contained the famous calendar pinup of Marilyn Monroe, which he bought from a printer. So it was from humble beginnings that Playboy's opulence, Playboy's politics, and eventually the Playboy philosophy took its place in America's consciousness.
In a pinched post-war America, Playboy celebrated spending. In an era of sexual repression, it made hedonism the ism of choice for the nation's elite. And by the way, it's still the leading men's magazine in the world. Coming up after the break, Hugh Hefner, Gay Talese, and America After Playboy.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 2003 will mark the golden anniversary of an American institution, an institution at least in its 50th year. In the early days, when Eisenhower's roamed the earth, Playboy magazine was a phenomenon for the very reason that it challenged the institutions of government and cultural propriety. Playboy's profound impact on American society was explored in the 1981 book Thy Neighbor's Wife. Author Gay Talese says that what distinguished Playboy was not nudity per se, but how the nudity was deployed.
Before there was Playboy, there were nudist magazines. One of the best known was Sunshine and Health. But those people in Sunshine and Health, the women, and there were men in Sunshine and Health, they were not necessarily attractive people. The whole point of the nudist magazine was to say to the reader, nudity is not ludity. What was important about Playboy was that the nude model, invariably a good-looking young woman, was looking at the camera and ergo making contact with the reader. And there was a kind of a illicit relationship between the man who is the consumer, the reader, and the woman who is the exhibitionist on the glossy pages of Playboy.
Now, America in the 50s was an America of I Like Ike and See the USA in Your Chevrolet and the Red Scare and the Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, and was certainly pre-sexual revolution, long before the birth control pill. What impact did Playboy and its near propriety have on the culture?
Hefner, in the 1950s, introduced into middle America a sense that women, with their clothes off, belonged in our lives, and they were okay. And that was the big thing, in the beginning at least, of Playboy's contribution to popular culture. What it did was bring to the jury system a diminution of being shocked by nudity, because they'd seen so much of it. All that nudity that Playboy extended into small towns and restricted areas and into home life, it gave a kind of a sense of being blasé toward the nude female form, so that when they, in pornography cases, voted whether to or whether not to punish a person who was brought up on charges of obscenity, they tended to acquit rather than convict.
But did the legal decisions that resulted from the anti-smut prosecutions by the postal inspectors and other agencies, did they extend beyond the issue of pornography into other areas of free speech?
They most certainly did. The dirty work was done by the pornographer. It wasn't done by Alfred A. Knopf or Random House or the Library Association of America. They did nothing in terms of free speech, nothing in terms of freedom of expression. It's because the smut peddlers took the beating in the courts. They fought the government. They fought the Catholic Legion of Decency. They fought the moral code, and they made it open for Arthur Miller, Philip Roth, John Updike, Joyce Carol Oates. They all owe to the smut peddler their freedom. Hefner is a major figure in fighting against repression, and that means any kind of repression. It isn't just the right to show naked women or naked men or whatever. That's part of it. But if you can show naked women, naked men, you can show a lot of nakedness in terms of language. You don't have to worry about putting a fig leaf on a verb, don't you see?
I want to ask you about Playboy Advisor, and which told you what stereo to buy and how to mix a martini, and the Playboy interviews, which went in-depth, as mainstream journalism seldom did, with very important cultural and political figures. and all of the things that are not the pictures of naked women that have defined Playboy low these past almost 50 years. Were these fabulous contributions to journalism ever anything fundamentally more than a delivery system for soft porn?
Obscenity, in order to be not obscene, has to have redeeming social value. So Playboy had, in addition to the naked women we all might have lusted for, redeeming social value in the form of a lot of boring interviews with Noam Chomsky that was there in the pages of Playboy. There were good writers, Irwin Shaw in the old days, and Norman Mailer, and John Updike, I mentioned again, and Joyce Carol Oates. But you take those girls and you banish them to Siberia, and Mr. Hefner and Playboy with him goes into receivership. He's out of business. He's back in Chicago without a swimming pool, without a jacuzzi, with nothing.
So if you happen to have a copy of Playboy, will you walk down the street with it in your hand, or will you shove it into your briefcase?
Let me tell you where I stand with Playboy. I don't read it. I never read it. I never have published a piece in it. I've never submitted an article to be published in Playboy. Okay? My defense of Playboy is because Playboy has made my life easier, so easy that I don't have to read or sell to Playboy. Playboy made my life and the life of every writer easier.
Well, Gay Talese, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Garfield.
Gay Talese is the author of Unto Thy Sons, The Kingdom and the Power, and Thy Neighbor's Wife.
The living embodiment of all things Playboy, the knight of the round bed and the silk pajamas, joins us now. Hugh Hefner, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
You know, it's an amazing thing you did, weaving together a passion for literature, civil rights, runny cheeses, and big breasts into what you call a viable aesthetic.
And it was an attempt to incorporate, in a positive way, a sexuality into the rest of the kinds of interests that a person spends their time on when they're not working. Our notion of playing hard was largely bowling and watching television, and there was more to life than that. I think that, you know, our traditional values, and our, they're rooted in our religious values, has pitted mind and body against one another. The notion that the devil is in the flesh. I didn't buy it when I was young. I don't buy it now.
But Playboy's tastes were so expensive. I mean, wasn't the Playboy philosophy therefore a little exclusive?
Well, obviously it wasn't. Some of the dreams and some of the gadgets were out of reach, but part of the magazine, both its sexuality and also related to consumerism, was a fantasy. A man's reach should exceed his grasp, else what's a heaven for? It's a motivation to dream.
In the Playboy philosophy, you quote from one of your most eloquent critics, Harvey Cox, who wrote a piece that was reprinted in various Christian journals of opinion and college newspapers. Can I read you his quote?
Sure, of course.
Moralistic criticisms of Playboy fail because its anti-moralism is one of the few places in which Playboy is right. Thus, any theological critique of Playboy that focuses on its lewdness will misfire completely. Playboy and its less successful imitators are not sex magazines at all. They dilute and dissipate authentic sexuality by reducing it to an accessory, by keeping it at a safe distance. And he concludes with, "We must see in Playboy the latest and slickest episode in man's continuing refusal to be fully human."
Well, I think that's very sophisticated semantics, but not very accurate. I mean, the reality is that far from being accessories, the romantic relationship between the sexes, expressed from a male point of view, is what Playboy is all about. It's what makes the world go around. The fine food and wine and the clothes and the cars and the gadgetry, those are the accessories. But the part that really matters is the connection between the opposite sex.
Here's a clip that we borrowed from your A&E biography. It's you being challenged by feminist Susan Brown Miller on the Dick Cavett Show. And we'll run that now.
The role that you have selected for women is degrading to women because you choose to see women as sex objects. You make them look like animals, yes. Women aren't bunnies. They're not rabbits. They're human beings. The day that you are willing to come out here with a cottontail attached to your rear end...
We've been accused, obviously, of exploiting women, exploiting sex. I think Playboy exploits sex. You know, I just think exploit is an unfortunate word. Playboy exploits sex like Sports Illustrated exploits sport.
Now, I noticed that you never responded to her specific challenge about the bunny tails. I mean, it would, after all, be antithetical to the Playboy aesthetic to attach a little fuzzy ball of cotton to your own tush, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think so.
But is that fair?
And that feminist diatribe didn't make a lot of sense back then. It seems very foolish today. I think that in the intervening years, women really have become truly human. That anti-sexual part of feminism is very antiquated and, quite frankly, was anti-revolutionary even at the time. To be truly human, women have to embrace their sexuality. And that's all Playboy's really all about. I think it's one of the reasons why the magazine and the Playboy symbols and why the rabbit image are so popular now with young women. And you see Playboy fashions in all the leading women's magazines. We have come a long ways, baby.
I think that's true, but I do think that some of that Playboy style that you're referring to, the bunny costumes, have certainly something to do with kitsch. And what's more, back in the early days when you were creating that costume and that image, it wasn't women expressing their own sexuality. It was women putting on the costume that you had designed for them. This wasn't them embracing their own sexuality. This was them embracing yours.
True.
So,
that's right. That's what makes it work.
But then doesn't Susan...
You're thinking about the opposite sex. I think that's what it's all about.
I don't want to spend a lot of time in this space arguing the fine points of feminism here. Certainly, these things can be approached with a greater sense of humor today when women have far more equality in every sphere, including the sexual sphere. But it could, at the time, certainly seem as if they were being put into a little bunny box.
Well, it seems so, obviously, to some people who... expressed those views, you know, in a political context, but didn't have much to do with reality.
Well, let's jump ahead to Playboy today. Playboy, as we said, is still the largest circulation men's magazine in the world, but here in the United States, magazines like Maxim are giving it a real run for its money. And the editors of Maxim say that one of its advantages is that it has no nudity, so men aren't embarrassed to buy it and carry it around.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. They get more advertising support and they get greater distribution. That's absolutely true. And that's a reflection of the fact that still in America, we do have rather unsophisticated attitudes towards sexuality and nudity.
Why do you think Playboy's circulation has declined from its peak of, what, 7 million back in 1972?
Well, I think that one has to think of it in a time frame. I mean, the 7 million circulation, which we reached in the early 1970s, was before video, before more explicit sexuality in many, many forms. It was a brief moment in history. The magazine circulation has been over 3 million for now for the last 20 years. So the magazine is very, very vital. But there are new forms of competition out there, and particularly the laddie books, Maxim and FHM and magazines like that, that are really kind of a downscale version of Playboy instead of the girls and the champagne, the babes and the beer. But like all the rest of the men's field, they are all variations really on Playboy. I think one of the remarkable things about the magazine is how much the readers connected with it, that it became for them more than just a magazine. It became a projection of really who they felt they wanted to be. And men look back now, and women too, on those first issues and when they first saw them in their adolescence. And it became and continues to be a kind of a rite of passage from adolescence into adulthood. And what we're looking for now as we approach our 50th anniversary is ways to revitalize the initial concepts of the magazine.
You were quoted in a story in the New York Observer last month saying that Playboy was looking to pull back from the explicit nature of its sexuality. How come?
Well, I think that explicit sexuality has less meaning today. You know, the speculation after that interview was that I was going to be taking the nudity out of the magazine. Now, that is obviously not my intention, but I think that we can do other kinds of things and emphasize other kinds of things in the magazine. What I'm looking for is an appropriate mix that is more satisfying.
Does that mean no more centerfold?
No, it certainly doesn't mean no centerfold.
Can you say anything about how the image of the Playboy bunny has evolved? Has she changed? I mean, does she still find walks on the beach a turn-on and mean people a turn-off?
Probably. some things in terms of humankind don't change that much.
What are you wearing?
Pajamas, of course.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Hugh Hefner started the Playboy Revolution 50 years ago.
An empire can be built, as we've seen, by helping men fantasize about lying down with naked ladies. But now, from the supine to the ridiculous. Here's a TV news clip.
A South American artist claims he has sculpted the world's largest nativity scene. The work features 130 life-size statues and a flock of sheep.
Nothing particularly notable about that story, except that the woman reading it was wearing no clothing. It was a story from Naked News, the on-demand cable program that has sprung from the 1999 web phenomenon, nakednews.com. Both are newscasts done in the nude. Anchor Victoria Sinclair has just rejoined Naked News after a year-long sabbatical, and she joins us by phone from Toronto. Victoria, welcome to our show.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
We're probably the last news organization in the world to report on Naked News, so bear with me here. But why a new show in the buff?
What we are, I think, Bob, is a product of our times. You know, right around the same time that we came onto the Internet thinking we were the only people in the world, it was occurring in Italy and it was occurring in Russia. So it was obvious people had the same idea around about the same time.
So are you a journalist, a pinup girl, both? What are you?
I'm not exactly either. I am an Internet webcaster. I do read the news. In my particular position, we do have writers who prepare that for us.
A full frontally nude webcaster.
Indeed, that's true.
Now, it's one thing to striptease while reporting, say, the index of leading economic indicators, but what about a suicide bombing? Isn't there a sort of cognitive dissonance there? Two very different sorts of, oh my God.
Well, we do have challenges like that to face every single day, of course. We skate along the razor's edge of what is tasteful and what is not. We can't provide ourselves as the Naked News and not provide news, and some of that news is pretty harsh to deal with. What we try and avoid is putting up extremely graphic photographs for, you know, that visual dichotomy. We don't need that. And we don't dwell on a lot of the gory details. We don't sensationalize it that way. We simply state the fact, this is what happened, suicide bomber. So we all know it was bad. All we have to do is say, this is what happened. We disrobe during our news broadcast, and we do try and time it or reorder the stories in a way that it isn't too jarring.
You left the program for a while. Why?
I left the program not that long after September 11th. My section of the news at that time was at the beginning of the show, so I had to deal with this every single day. And it just made me sadder and sadder, and I was finding no joy whatsoever in my job and decided that, okay, it's time for me to take a break.
But you're back, so what's next for you? I mean, I'd like to think that because of your job, you've foreclosed on the possibility of working for a major network delivering the news, but you probably haven't. Is that your ambition?
Well, it's certainly a possibility still. Absolutely, I'd like to make the leap, and not just personally, not just for me, so I have a better career, but mostly just to show people that that kind of a leap is possible, that because I do this naked does not mean that I can be pegged as a certain kind of a person. I think it's important to recognize that freedom of speech is something that needs to be experienced and acted upon, and not just a pretty piece of paper in a museum in order for it to be real. Say in advertising, people are really accustomed to being manipulated shamelessly with sexual images, and they just shrug your shoulders and say, oh, well, that's the advertising business. But let a woman be attractive and unclothed and open her mouth, and suddenly that raises a lot more eyebrows. But someone's got to do that first, and that just happens to be us. I think we're trailblazers.
Okay, trailblazers. I have one more question for you.
Certainly.
So, what are you wearing?
Pardon me?
What are you wearing?
What am I wearing right now?
Mm-hmm.
I'm wearing platform boots, black pants, and a stripy sweater from The Gap.
Oh. Well, Victoria, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Victoria Sinclair is the lead anchor for Naked News. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan and Jamie York. Engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Natasha Kurgankar and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.